Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. There are two surprising elections that have been called in Europe. In the UK, Rishi Sunak called the general election for July 4th at what seems like the worst time for Tory rule. And across the pond, the far right gained in European parliamentary elections, moving Emmanuel Macron to call a snap election in France that will be held on June 30th for the first round and July 7th for the second. He didn't have to do it. Any more than Sunak did, though Macron's government isn't teetering like Sunak's. But what's behind these elections, and what are the possible outcomes? And why now? To get a deeper analysis and perspective, we turn to Sebastian Budgen in Paris when our program returns in just a moment. We'll also ask for your support in this summer fund drive by calling 818-985-5735. Welcome back. I'm Susie Wiseman. After the strong showing for the far right in the European parliamentary elections on June 9th, specifically Marine Le Pen's Rassemblement National, Emmanuel Macron surprisingly called a snap election in France for June 30 and July 7th. It's been called an earthquake in French politics. What's behind this seemingly very gutsy, even crazy move? Conventional wisdom has it that after the right trounced the center in the European elections, Macron called the election because he was certain the divisions in the left would make him the rational choice, apparently betting that the center can hold. But the left has responded to this new reality by getting its act together and forming a new popular front consisting of Jean-Luc Mélenchon's France Insoumise, the Socialist Party, the Greens, and the Communist Party. It is increasingly positioned to form a new government, according to the New York Times on June 21st, that could weaken Macron's grip on power. We'll get that story from Sebastian Budgen. And we're also going to talk to Sebastian about Europe's other surprising election across the channel in the UK, where Prime Minister Rishi Sunak called a general election for July 4th at what seems like the worst possible time for Tory rule. And just as Macron didn't have to call the elections now, neither did Sunak. It seems even worse for Sunak because his government is teetering. The Tory party is almost imploding, whereas Macron's is just unpopular. What's behind both of these elections, and what are the possible outcomes? Why now? To get a deeper analysis and perspective, we turn to Sebastian Budgen in Paris. Sebastian, welcome to the program.
Happy to be back, Susie.
Thank you. And Sebastian Budgen is editorial director for Verso Books, and he serves on the editorial board of Historical Materialism. He has analyzed French politics here on this program and on the NLR blog, New Left Review blog called Sidecar. And he's joining us from Paris, where he lives. So, Sebastian, lots to cover here today, but we'll start with France. The European elections, as I said, caused an earthquake in French politics with Macron calling a snap election. Can you explain it?
Well, it is quite a complicated and difficult to understand situation. I think we have to start with the backstory, which, to remind everybody, in 2022, Macron won the second round of the presidential elections against Marine Le Pen. Unfortunately, Jean-Luc Mélenchon didn't get through to the second round by a whisker. So it was a face-off between Macron and Le Pen, and Macron won the presidential elections. However, immediately after that followed the legislative elections, the parliamentary elections, and the tripartition of the country between three blocks, the far right, the left, and the center block was confirmed. And Macron, unlike in his previous term, did not get absolute majority in the National Assembly. So since 2022, his party has had to try and find various alliances, particularly with the now small Républicain right-wing force, previous, right-wing party, to pass their various measures. And as we know, many of them were extremely unpopular, like the pension reform program. So he's been facing this very unstable situation where there are constant votes of no confidence in the National Assembly and difficulty getting through his legislation and his neoliberal reforms. So what happened with the European elections was that there was a big push of support for the Rassemblement National, which is basically just the renamed Front National, led by their new young front person, Jordan Bardella, although Marine Le Pen is still very much in control of the party. And they got over 30% in the polls. that was something like twice what the Macroniste party won, and then third place, the left, which was not united in the European elections, was standing on the different list. So there have been various theories about why Macron has taken this move. Now, this move is to dissolve the Legislative Assembly and have new legislative elections in a very short period of time, so only 2 weeks or so to campaign, which is quite unprecedented. It doesn't affect his presidency, obviously. His term runs out in 2027. But there have been various theories about why he's taken this wild gamble. One is effectively that, indeed, that he thought the left being divided could allow him to stand again, as he did in the presidential elections, as the force for democracy and freedom and so on and so forth against the far right. A second theory is that he knows that that's very unlikely outcome, because the center, so-called center party that he represents is collapsing, and that he was betting on the Rassemblement National winning the legislative elections, winning either relative or an absolute majority, and for there to be a cohabitation for more than 2 years between him as president and Jordan Bardella for the Rassemblement National as prime minister. And presumably the calculation, if that's true, was that the Rassemblement National would delegitimate itself in power, and somehow then that would set the scene for a Macroniste return in the 2027 presidential elections. He can't stand again, can't stand for more than two consecutive runs, but somebody else could take his place. So those are the two most popular theories. There are other more extravagant ones. I mean, what was also very surprising about this is that he planned all of this with a very small group of advisors and didn't even inform his own prime minister, Gabriel Attal, until a few hours before it was announced. So the whole Macroniste party was taken totally by surprise by this shock announcement. In any case, whatever his intentions were, they certainly seemed to be turning rather differently from what he expected.
There's a couple of questions that come out of that, but I wanted to go back just first, before we move into the composition, let's say, of the right and its politics and the left, but just back for a second to the European elections, because everybody watching those European elections thought that the right would do even better than it did, so it didn't gain quite as much. And that's had this effect that you've mentioned, that it caused Macron to call a snap election, or a quick election, not called a snap election. And one of the things that is argued in Sidecar by Christopher Bickerton is, for the reason that the right didn't do as well as it could have, was the cautionary tale of Brexit's catastrophe, which for the rest of Europe and its far right, because in Britain, Brexit did not succeed in curbing inward immigration, and it taught Europe's far right that leaving Europe doesn't solve their problems. And the other thing that happened in the European elections is that the Greens did poorly. Now, I know that's a little different than in France, because in France, not the Greens, but the Ecological Party, as you call it, I think, is part of this coalition. But I just wondered how you think the European Parliament's overall politics in this election affected French politics, if it did at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult to argue that the Rassemblement National didn't do as well as people expected in France. It was a historic victory for them, and in almost every single constituency in France, apart from the big cities, they were the first party. They came at the head. If you look at the map of France and all its constituencies, it's almost completely brown, with some tiny red dots around, as I say, particularly the big cities and the banlieue. So it was a very big, substantial victory for the far right in France, with very high abstention rates, we must remember, about half the population. But what is true is that on the European level, as a whole, the far right's results, although very good for them, were somewhat more mixed. For example, in the Netherlands, they came second rather than first. In the Scandinavian countries, surprisingly, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, and so on, they didn't have great results. And in Germany, obviously, where the alternative to Germany, the AfD, was standing, they were beset by a whole series of scandals, including their lead spokesperson for the European elections giving an interview to an Italian newspaper where he claimed that not all SS people claimed to be Nazis during the Second World War. So they got a very good result, but they didn't get the result they were being predicted a few months earlier. So, yeah, I think generally speaking, the rise of the far right across Europe has had an impact on French politics, and there's obviously a legitimization of the far right that's going on across the European political field. We can see that particularly in Italy with Giorgia Meloni, who you all remember that photograph of Biden kissing her on the head. You know, she's thrown in her lot with the Atlanticist pro-Ukraine campaign, so now everything else is forgiven. But there are obviously specificities about the French situation that have to be discussed as well. Can't just absorb it into the general European.
Well, let's talk about that in terms of the right in Europe, but specifically in France, because it looks like, even though the far right, you know, swept the European elections for Marine Le Pen's party, it also moderated itself somewhat, or maybe it hasn't. It just seems, you know, that they're able to adapt more to general politics than, let's say, Trump is in the United States. This is left to be seen, of course, in the remaining months of our election. But can you talk a little bit more about Marine Le Pen's party and what are its real politics now, and why is it getting such a strong showing in France?
Yeah, so one must remember that the Front National, the predecessor, the Rassemblement National, was a regroupment of fascist parties and its origin influence of Waffen-SS and collaborators. So it was very clearly a party of the far right, and it was led, of course, by Jean-Marie Le Pen, who didn't make much of a secret about his views on racism, including on anti-Semitism, the rest of it, and who, you know, as a soldier in Algeria, was responsible for torturing suspected FLN militants and so on. So that was very clear. What has happened since Marine Le Pen took power is that she's tried to polish the image of the Front National, and of course now renamed it, in this process of what's called de-demonization, namely to try and remove as many as possible of the obvious elements that hark back to an older form, if you like, of far-right politics. So particularly on the question of anti-Semitism, has replaced that entirely with Islamophobia, and she professes, of course, total support for Israel. So on societal issues, you know, she refuses to support bans on abortion and, you know, homophobic legislation. And on social and economic issues has played, if you like, quote-unquote, to the left. She has a strong working class base, and she talks about the fact that the Macron government, you know, a globalist government, wants to tear up, you know, public services and doesn't care about French workers, but not, i.e. white workers. So there has been a so-called de-demonization of their politics, but the fundamentals of their politics remain exactly the same. It's what they call national preference, so giving preference in housing and jobs and all the other key areas to white French workers, massive deportations of immigrants, closing the borders to immigrants, extremely hard law and order line to crack down on social movements and left opposition movements, and so on, all of the things that you would expect from a far-right party. But the image is very much smoother, as is her spokesperson, Jordan Bardella, a very young guy, 29 years old or something like that, described as every person's ideal son-in-law. And during the legislature, during this last 2 years, the Front National, which had a record number of MPs, has been playing the card of respectability. So they were turning up in suits and ties and talking about how they wanted to be constructive opposition and counterposing themselves to La France Insoumise, who were coming in shirts with no ties, who were being loud and disruptive about the reforms that Macron was trying to introduce, and saying, we are a party government, we're responsible, we're serious. Now, Bardella has been meeting with French bosses and saying that maybe the things that he was promising before that were a bit, you know, socially adventurous, like rowing back on the pension reforms, that can be wait till later, so on and so forth. So they're abandoning their social and economic promises in order to gain this idea of electoral respectability.
But does this work for them? I mean, because you're saying that they're trying to appeal to the French, at least white working class, and they aren't proposing drastic cuts in social services, at least for them. Is this working?
Well, the backing down has only been happening during these last few days as the idea of them coming to power has become more and more concrete. There have been contacts between the Rassemblement National and the various members of the French capitalist class up to now, but there was a certain suspicion of them being supposedly too left-wing on social and economic issues. And that's why if you're on the far right and you're bourgeois in France, you would have voted for Éric Zemmour rather than Marine Le Pen, because Éric Zemmour was a clear and open neoliberal. But now these contacts have gone into overdrive, and it is at the latest, it happened yesterday, there was a meeting between the Bosses Federation and which all the parties presented their economic programs, and their conclusion was that the economic program of the Rassemblement National was dangerous, but that of the left was even more dangerous.
So in other words, what you're saying then is that the Bosses organization will likely continue to support Macron over the right?
No, I think they are reconciling themselves with the Rassemblement National in the eventuality, which seems to be pretty likely, of the Macronist bloc dissolving. And as was said, you know, the slogan in 1936 when the first Front Populaire came around, the bourgeois class slogan was rather Hitler than Léon Blum, who was the socialist leader of the Front Populaire. So I think they're coming round full circle to that position, rather the far right, even if distasteful, than the left.
So let's move to the left then. This was, as you said earlier, Sebastian, part of Macron's reasoning that the left was too divided to get its act together, therefore he could make this gutsy move. And the left surprised at least everyone in the rest of the world, perhaps not in France, by getting its act together. Can you talk about the constituent parties, what has prevented them before from coming together into this kind of a front, or is this very similar to the front that was formed earlier in 2022? Give us the lowdown on all of that.
Well, what we must remember about the situation since 2022 is that it's a quite unique situation where you have all the forces of the left being dominated by the most radical amongst them, i.e. La France Insoumise, on a very radical program, both domestically and internationally. They won the most number of seats in the left coalition in 2022. The former party of government, the Socialist Party, was extremely badly. They had a risible result, under 2% in the presidential elections, if you remember, and they were reduced enormously compared to the past. The Greens also were reduced, and the Communist Party had a small number of seats. So you had a totally unique situation in, I think, the world where the left is dominated by its most radical wing rather than the other way around. There have been a lot of arguments within that left, as you would expect, over the last few years about politics, about Ukraine, about Gaza, how radically to oppose the pension reforms, and so on and so forth. And particularly since the 7th of October, there's been a disintegration of the previous left coalition, the NUPES, because of La France Insoumise's radical support of the Palestinians' right to resist, their refusal to characterize Hamas as a terrorist organization, although they, of course, condemned the what they call terrorist act on the 7th of October, and they're campaigning for a ceasefire and so on. And, of course, the more moderate elements of the left, extremely unhappy with that, talked about how there was anti-Semitism and so on and so forth. There was a march against anti-Semitism, for example, in Paris that Macron's party organized, that the far right participated in. All the left parties except La France Insoumise participated in that march. La France Insoumise chose to not participate in a march, which they quite rightly, I think, said was re-legitimizing the far right, but they got enormous amounts of flak for that. So all these left parties, the Greens, the Communists, the Socialists, and La France Insoumise went into the European elections divided, bickering amongst each other, criticizing each other very strongly. What happened in the European elections is there was a slight change in the relationship of forces. The Socialist Party, under the leadership of this chap, Raphael Glucksmann, did better than obviously had done in the presidential elections and all the previous legislative elections. They got 13%, whereas La France Insoumise got around 10%. So, of course, the center-left was delighted about this and said, this is a complete game changer, this changes everything, you know, the Socialist Party is back, the moderate, responsible left is back, and so on and so forth. So nobody was expecting that in this highly charged and competitive political environment, these forces would be able to, you know, had been basically insulting each other and polemicizing against each other for the previous few months, would be able to come together so quickly in a matter of hours and proclaim a new popular front. And, of course, the negotiations have been extremely hard about, you know, various political concessions that have been made on different sides on a whole number of questions. So it is a more moderate program, if you like, than the program that La France Insoumise was able to push through during the 2022 legislative elections, but it is still a force where the La France Insoumise is the dominant party. It would win fewer seats than it would have won if it had been the same configuration in 2022, but it will still be the, assuming, you know, they win the seats that they're hoping to win, it could still be the dominant partner in the new assembly.
So it's really quite interesting because, well, I guess the question is, how much international events affected domestic events? And you're saying that October 7th was a huge factor because it created differences around, I guess, how much to blame Hamas for what's going on and how much to blame Israel, if I'm reading you correctly. And then the other part, of course, is Ukraine. And it's interesting, I'm just curious, what are the divisions around supporting Ukraine versus, let's say, perhaps the Communist Party giving backhanded support to Russia?
No, nobody's supporting Russia. Communist Party's moved a long way away from that. La France Insoumise and the Communist Party, they oppose the Russian invasion and they defend the right of the Ukrainians to defend themselves, but they say they're against a bellicist program on the part of the French government. For example, the idea that French troops would be sent to Ukraine, as Macron recently suggested, and they say that priority should be given to peace talks. The Socialist Party, particularly Raphael Glucksmann, who's actually in a micro-party, but he represents the centre-left, if you like, have been an extremely aggressive pro-arms to Ukraine program, saying that completely unconditional and total support for arming the Ukrainians, whatever form is necessary, and that this is a red line for them. They're very much tied to the Atlanticist approach to the Ukraine of really using it as a proxy war for the threat of NATO into Ukraine.
What about the rest of the domestic economic program? It's certainly, as you started to mention, that France Insoumise had the most radical program, but what we're seeing now is the Popular Front still supports an increase in the minimum wage, the repeal of the very unpopular pension reform, raising the age, a retirement age in France, investment in public services, plus ecological planning. So was this much of an argument for the various parties in the front?
Well, of course, they had very little time to discuss all this because the emphasis has been trying to, in this extremely short campaign time, to try and put up a united position. And it doesn't make a lot of sense running against the far right on a moderate social and economic program, given that the Rassemblement National itself, you know, trying to pose as a champion of French working class. So I think the Socialist Party particularly have swallowed a lot of things on the domestic front that they wouldn't in normal circumstances have been prepared to swallow. But, you know, they have moderated the program. You know, France Insoumise was in favor of not just going back on the pension reforms, but pushing back the pension age to 60 from the original 62. Now it's said that the first stage will be to push back 62 and then in a second stage, talk about pushing back to 60, these kinds of things the Socialist Party has braked on. Of course, there is a right wing of the Socialist Party that is absolutely spitting mad about these concessions and will try and get its revenge one way or another after the election.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the representatives of this right wing is, very surprisingly, François Hollande, former president, is standing as an MP under the new Popular Front for his local constituency. Nobody saw that one coming.
Wow. Just on that last part, not on Lund, but on the program, the economic program, you mentioned earlier that the so-called left politics of the far right is only left for the white working class. But where do they stand on, say, a Green New Deal or ecological planning and more investment in public services, repealing the pension reform?
The far right.
Yeah.
The far right doesn't obviously want to have anything to do with any ecological measures. They are in favor of, you know, fossil capitalism. And, you know, their main thing that does have some traction amongst working class people is about, you know, taxes on petrol. and other forms of fossil fuels. On pension reforms, as I said, they claimed that they were against the pension reforms that now seem to be backing down on it. And on public services, they say they're against the ripping up of public services, but they don't have, obviously, a redistributive program for saying how they would finance public services. They say that they will make all the savings through the anti-immigration measures that they will push through, which is obviously completely ridiculous. But, you know, they're just sort of hand-waving about where they would get the money from. And it's clear, as I say, at the moment, with the rapprochement that they're trying with the boss class, that they won't be in favor of any serious tax increases for the rich, that's for sure.
So let's just get to this last question about France before we move to Britain, and that is, you know, this whole process is very fast. It's, as you mentioned, just in a couple of weeks, or actually less than 2 weeks, that you have the first round. But as it was in the beginning, everyone feared that this was just about the far right and the center, and that the left wouldn't get it together. But the left did get it together, and now even the New York Times is saying that they're going to cause some problem. And, you know, there's articles saying that the left can win. So what do you think, and what does it look like on the ground?
It's very difficult to tell. As I say, the time that we have available is extremely short. The vote is in a week on Sunday, first round. Then there will be a second round of legislative elections. The polls seem to suggest that there is a relatively tight race between the far right and the left, but the far right is still ahead. So, you know, some polls are showing, for example, the far right at 33% and the left 28% or 35% versus 29%. There was one poll that showed the far right at 29.5% and the left at 28.5%. I mean, a lot will depend, of course, on the turnout. One of the big issues La France Insoumise has been campaigning very successfully on, although not as successfully as will be needed to beat the far right, is turning out the abstentionists, particularly in the working class neighborhoods and the banlieue. 50% abstention during the European election. If there was a massive, massive turnout of electors from those places, then you could see a very tight result or potentially, ideally, a left victory. What is true is that in the rural areas, it's going to be, you know, pretty likely the Rassemblement National is going to do fantastically well. So that will outweigh those results. And then, of course, what will also affect who has a majority, or if there is any majority, is what happens in the second round following Sunday, because how will the Macronists position themselves when there are runoffs between the far right and the left? At the moment, they are saying both are as bad as each other, and maybe the left are worse than the far right. Will their electorate follow them or not, is the big question.
Is there any way that there isn't a second round if, say, either one of them does, gets enough votes in the first, or is that just there's always a second round?
There is always a second round, yeah, unless you get, you know, a complete victory on the first round, but that's very rare when you have so many parties competing. So there's going to be runoffs in virtually all the constituencies. Some of them will be runoffs which will be very tight. Some of them, there'll be a party that's going to win, and there may even be three cornered runoffs in some cases.
Well, we're going to have to turn to you after the 7th to see what happens and get your analysis of how it went. But let's turn to Britain now, because in Britain, Rishi Sunak announced his election prior to this earthquake in France. But it seemed really incredible that what looked like the worst moment for the Tory government, that he would decide to call elections. You know, I was wondering, was it an early admission of defeat, or was it just complete suicide? The Tory party is falling apart. How do you see it?
Well, again, I mean, the difference with Rishi Sunak compared to Macron is that his party is deeply, deeply divided and is full of plotters who are trying to get rid of him as prime minister, just as they did the previous prime ministers. And, of course, there is a hard faction in the Conservative Party that wants to push the Conservative Party even further to the right and potentially, you know, there's talk of, you know, some kind of fusion with the Reform Party, which is the new name for the UK Independence Party, the pro-Brexit party under Nigel Farage. So there is clearly a far-right faction that is extremely hostile to Rishi Sunak, who see him as some kind of centrist, which is absurd, but there we go, from their perspective. and that's made life extremely uncomfortable for him. The other thing that's made things very difficult for him is that the Labour Party has now had this massive lead in the polls for months, years almost. So, you know, that's a big pressure. So I think there's probably a personal gamble for Rishi Sunak. You know, people talk about how if he loses, he'll be able to, you know, run off to California. He's extremely rich, and so is his wife, who's a multimillionaire. So, you know, there'll be an easy exit for him that way if he exits British politics. But I suppose there is also some kind of calculation that if you call the electorate bluff, they won't want a Labour government because they can. The usual Tory strategy is to threaten that everybody will get taxed. Rises under Labour government, and then, you know, there's a kind of anti-woke sort of aspect to the Tories' anti-Labour campaigns, which they hope will also rally people to them to their side. I mean, I suspect it was just an act of putting the government out of its misery, to be honest, because it was, as I say, so internally divided, and the idea of turning the wave of Labour lead in the polls was not going to happen just by eking it out, and that therefore some kind of definitive movement had to be made to provoke a result.
Well, before we get into the Labour Party and all of its problems that got it to the, you know, to where it is today, can you talk a little bit more about, you know, the 14 years of Tory rule and austerity that has left so much damage? It's my sense that even the Tories constituency do not support all the cuts in the National Health Service, that the National Health Service is popular all around, and yet it's kind of wobbling, and I think I read that there's 7 million people in Britain who are on a wait list for one or another medical services, and that wasn't the case before. So I want to get your sense on that, what the Conservative base that came to the Conservative Party because of Brexit, largely, but do they support that kind of position?
Well, the Conservative base is socially split. I mean, you have a traditional social base for the Conservatives, which is a petit bourgeois, right-wing, working-class base, which, you know, is in favor of neoliberalism and privatization all the way, you know, the traditional kind of Thatcherite base of the Conservative Party. But what they were able to do at the last elections with the famous Red Wall, overthrow of the Red Wall, was win a whole number of northern English constituencies which were held by the Labour Party, and there was this so-called program of levelling up. Boris Johnson talked about levelling up, so, you know, the idea that the poorer areas of Britain, poorer regions of Britain would be brought up to the level of the southeast of England and London, so on, and the wealthier areas. Obviously, this was completely empty talk, but it had some kind of impact on voters, disgruntled voters, where the Labour Party vote was in any case in decline because of many years of absolutely dispiriting Labour rule. So that part of the votership, of the voter base, is very attached to the National Health Service and some other aspects of the welfare state. Of course, some of them are also attracted by the anti-immigrant and anti-scrounger propaganda of the Tory Party, saying that, you know, yes, we want to defend our welfare state and our National Health Service, but not for immigrants, not for people who are just scrounging off us, people who are work shy, etc., etc. So, you know, there is obviously that kind of contradictory consciousness, which is a long-standing feature of British working class politics, but. You know, I think it's quite divided. There's a lot of hypocrisy about the National Health Service. You know, no Tory will openly admit to wanting to privatise it, but it's clear that, you know, they do over the long term by precisely putting it in a situation where it's underfunded so that its service becomes worse and worse and people become disillusioned with it. And, you know, in some senses, they've been quite successful at doing that.
So let's move to Starmer, because the Labour Party, of course, has been in a lot of disarray. Corbyn, when he was the leader of the party, failed to win in the elections, but he did make the Labour Party the largest, let's call it, left social democratic party in Europe. But then, you know, the right within the Labour Party struck back. Starmer became the leader. He has a left background, but he's, I guess, would you call him even centre-left? He seems, or centre-right, he seems, he first of all expelled Corbyn, expelled most of the left, so shrunk the Labour Party. but did so, it appears, to make itself more palatable to rule in the eyes of business and finance. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, Starmer came to power after Corbyn, promising Corbynism or some version of Corbynism without Corbyn, and taking a very hard line on the allegations of supposed anti-Semitism, and making concessions all the way to the those who work basically pushing a pro-Israel position in the Labour Party. What he did in practice was that he cracked down, as you said, on the left. Has engaged in wide-scale expulsions of suspensions, most obviously of Jeremy Corbyn, but along the line, and has also pulled the party so far to the right that all the tens of thousands of young people, but also other people who joined the Labour Party in enthusiasm for the rejuvenation that it underwent under Corbyn, have drifted away or left slamming the door. And so the idea is, a new version of Blairism, if you like, without the shiny glamour of it, but a sort of stolid, sensible Blairism, which won't necessarily commit Britain to going to war with the Americans in Iraq, but will still basically be a very right-wing set of policies. So, he's clearly auditioning as the B-team, capitalism's B-team in Britain, and he's been quite successful at doing that. He has run into problems, particularly, again, over Gaza, because he took a very reactionary position about the ceasefire and about the Israeli war in Gaza, and that had a big backlash in terms of the particularly the Muslim vote, but also, more generally, young people very disillusioned with him. And of course, recently, a few months ago, they lost a by-election, which went to George Galloway again, third time round, running against the Labour Party candidate on a pro-Palestine position. So they've had to try and finesse that. But aside from those kinds of complications, they've managed to reposition themselves as a right-wing social democratic force, which will be a stable, less chaotic than the Tories, representative of British capitalist interest as a whole.
They're polling, as you said, I think 20 points ahead, and nobody's doubting that Labour is going to, massively win. But is there a problem, let's say, of the left and perhaps, the Muslim community just staying home in this election? Or how do you see that part?
There is a problem of abstention and of mobilizing their base, clearly. You have to remember, however, that the British electoral system is incredibly unfair on any kinds of criteria, to be honest. It's the first past the post system with a single round, not unlike the French, where you have at least two chances. You have a chance to vote for something and a vote against something. British system is extremely unfair. So I think that unless there is a complete turnaround of the Tory party vote, certainly a crushing majority in terms of parliamentary seats, pretty like what that means in terms of the overall percentage of their vote nationally is open to question. But the Tories were very successful with this electoral system, and now it's being turned against them. They were able to win massive majorities on votes that were not particularly that significant in terms of overall percentages, and now they're going to pay the price for that. There's one poll that showed that the Reform Party is ahead of the Tory party in terms of national percentage, but that doesn't mean that they will win a large number of seats.
Does that mean because the Tory party is just in the toilet, essentially, and that so the Reform is slightly above that?
Partly, but there is a burst, if you like, after Britain is the only country in Europe where an organised far-right party has not managed to consolidate itself, and only did so around the question, very specific question of Brexit. All the other attempts, the National Front, the British National Party, and so on and so forth, were smashed by the far left and by the left as a whole. And so no space was given to them to grow. Of course, the Tory party was able to absorb some of those energies. It's possible that we could see a recomposition of British politics with the emergence of a substantial far-right party around Reform that would absorb some of the right-wing conservatives, and they're claiming that they will replace the conservatives as the main opposition party. This seems unlikely in the short term, but maybe in the medium term, that's not impossible.
But behind Britain's catastrophic economic slide in these 14 years of Tory rule has been Brexit. And I don't know where Starmer was on Brexit. The Labour Party was sort of back and forth. But how is that perceived now? Is it still an issue? Is there any discussion of trying to rejoin Europe? And is that even possible? Would Europe have them?
No, nobody really wants to talk about Brexit for good reasons, because it divided all the parties and it's been an embarrassing event all around, you know, for everybody involved. It certainly didn't live up to the promises of the Brexiteers. And the Remainers clearly think, at least the least delirious of them, realize that, you know, their particularly middle class obsession with certain aspects of the Remain campaign don't really have much of a foothold in the wider population. So it's something people don't really want to talk about. That's taken now as a given that Britain is outside of the European Union. Starmer was, as the Labour Party was, campaigning for Remain. But, you know, as we know, Corbyn was somewhat unenthusiastic about that because he had many justified criticisms of the European Union. So now, no, I think there's no real party. Maybe the Liberal Democrats talk about this, I don't know. But I don't think there's any serious force that is proposing to rejoin the European Union at this stage. And as you say, who would want them, to be honest, at this point within the European Union? They have enough of their own problems with the rise of the far right. But there will be talks about what new kinds of relationships, economic relationships, to build with the European Union after the election.
In the last minutes, I want you to talk more about the left in Britain, because it really did sort of collapse, although now we've seen very impressive mobilization around the war in Gaza, especially of young people, and that's been true, of course, internationally, but it was striking in Britain as well. And then, as you mentioned, there's been this split, and George Galloway is back, and you have, you know, I don't know, Paul Mason saying on Twitter that Starmer is really the soft left and, you know, and Galloway represents the old Stalinist left. Is there any currency to that? And how are most people, you know, sort of viewing what they might do and where they stand? And I guess finally on that, is immigration still an issue?
I mean, anybody who takes anything that Paul Mason says seriously really needs to, you know, take a time out. Paul Mason has become a complete caricature of himself and flipped from being pro-Corbyn to a pro-NATO, pro-Starmer pact, really. So I don't think anybody takes Paul Mason seriously anymore. Of course, George Galloway is, if you like, an AMPist and a Stalinist and a tanky in many ways. But, you know, the Labour Party have only themselves to blame about him winning the seat, because he ran, as I say, largely on a pro-Palestine position, just like he won the previous seats on an anti-Iraq war position. So, no, I don't think that there's anything serious about that. Nobody, I mean, only Paul Mason can think that Keir Starmer is soft left. I mean, there's just absolutely no basis for that whatsoever. What is true, yes, immigration is unfortunately still a key issue, and of course the Tories have been trying to milk this as much as possible, particularly with their ridiculous idea of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda. Camps in Rwanda, they managed to send, I think, one so far. It's going to be one of the most expensive and farcical programs, and obviously extremely cruel and repressive, but it does appeal to a certain racist element in their electorate. As far as the left is concerned, I mean, what to say? Yes, there have been big social movements. Unfortunately, the energy and spirit of the Corbyn period has been largely dissipated and, I think, to be honest, wasted. Jeremy Corbyn did have an opportunity when he was suspended and then expelled from the Labour Party. He created an organisation, Peace and Justice Movement, but it's remained largely an empty shell. It doesn't really represent anything. It's not a mass organising force. So I think we'll have to wait until the rebellions against the Starmer government to begin to see, one hopes, a reorganisation of the left in some kind of political form, although I'm sure there will be many social movements as well. I hope so, at least.
Well, I wanted you to talk about both France and England, thinking that there was, you know, some parallel in both Sunak and Macron calling these rapid elections when they didn't have to do so. But now that I've heard you speak, I kind of think that there isn't as much in common. I don't know, do you think that the French election, which will now, well, actually, actually, the British election will happen while the French election is taking place. Do you see any repercussions of one result on another, or do you see the Brits really across the pond and isolated?
Well, you know, the British and the French like to ignore each other. One of the kind of traditions, you know, it happens on the left as well as on the right and in the center. I think what's similar about the two situations is that the neoliberal consensus is clearly in the process of cracking up, but the forms it's taking that crack up are very different. In the French situation, it's taking a very dramatic form with this realignment, perhaps split of a three-pole system into a two-pole system, left versus far right. In Britain, it's the potentialities that existed for such a situation have been wasted, as I say, and it looks more like, at least in the short term, the left of centre will succeed in positioning itself as an alternative to the Tory party. But that doesn't change the fact that, you know, the legitimacy for neoliberalism, whether it's under its hard form or under its social liberal form, are deeply affected, and that, you know, people are, just as they are in France, completely fed up and disgusted with the political system as it currently exists. It just happens to be that in France there's more potential for that to manifest itself for good or ill, whereas in the British system, because of its peculiar form and structure, it's managed to contain those energies for the moment. But we may well see in the short to medium term some dramatic changes also in Britain.
Thank you so much for that, Sebastian. I have to say I agree with you. It seemed really kind of odd that there would be a neoliberal comeback in the form of, as you called it, a form of Blairism with Keir Starmer. And you did say there will be fights to come, and I'm sure of it. But I want to thank you so much for your analysis and helping our listeners here in the U.S. try to understand what's going on in Europe and perhaps to draw some parallels to our own election that's happening in November. But that's a completely different issue. Thanks for joining us today, Sebastian. And I should just let everybody know he is the editorial director of Verso Books. Verso, it needs no introduction. And he's also on the editorial board of Historical Materialism. And we're talking to him in France today. Thanks, Sebastian.
Thanks.
I'm back here, and I'm joined by Alan Minsky. He is no stranger to our airwaves. He spent many years as our program director, and he is now the executive director of Progressive Democrats for America. And I think you can guess it, but we're here to ask you for your support. And it's a really important message that we bring you. KPFK, and part of the Pacifica Foundation, is not funded by, as you know, corporations or anything else. We are entirely a listener-sponsored radio station, not a listener-supported radio station. We don't ask for your support along with a bunch of underwriting, but we just ask for your sponsorship, and this is the time that we need you to do it. So we're going to ask you to call in at 818-985-5735 and support this radio station and specifically this program, Beneath the Surface. And I'm going to let Alan talk to you for just a second. But I want to say that, you know, I've been on the air for a very long time. And of late, I've been sort of specializing, almost by default, on topics that I feel we can go into some depth on. One of them, of course, is in my own area of, let's call it expertise, and that's the former Soviet Union and Russia. Putin is as repressive, more repressive than we could have imagined, and so I've been covering a lot of that, and also labor, which I continue to cover. And this week, of course, we bring you the very important elections in Britain and France with Sebastian Budgen. And these are kinds of topics that, you know, are not necessarily covered even on our own radio station in any kind of depth, so I have nothing but fun bringing them to you, and we'd like to hear your support for it. Alan?
Yeah, no, and I really want people to think about Susie's show and the kind of understanding that she provides for, obviously she just talked about some European politics. She has exceptional coverage, of course, of Latin America and really of the whole globe. And what she provides is capacity to look beneath the surface, right, famous name of the show, and to see the sort of broader historical trends that are playing out in the specific manner in which they're playing out in all of these countries. And it sheds light on what our reality is living in the 21st century with much greater depth than you get in almost any analysis on any show I know of anywhere else in American media. And I mean that. You're quite privileged in a way to be able to hear beneath the surface over the airwaves of Southern California. You know, you can look at the immediate issues of contemporary politics in the framework of the broad arc of history with a deep understanding of the forces that are really driving that history. And there are, of course, in many ways, material forces, but there are also political ideologies at play. And you see the long arc of history, and that sheds incredible light on the present. And you get a deeper understanding of what's going on in the current politics much more than you do with the conventional surface analysis, which, again, it just seems sort of like these chaotic situations where, I mean, how is it that the United States of America has Joe Biden and Donald Trump as the two nominees of the two political parties in the dominant country in the world? What does that say about the state of America? And what are the forces that have driven our political system to be so sclerotic at this moment? And I bet you, you're not going to find any show out there that's going to offer up as much insight into that reality than Beneath the Surface with Susie Weisman. And that's just on domestic U.S. politics, which, by the way, you, as you talked about the things you focus on, you do focus on domestic U.S. politics as well and domestic U.S. economy. And notably, you do have a lot of the framing around the now growing and energetic union movement in the country, which, again, speaks to the way that our society reproduces itself, the general function of the society, and how that underlies the surface political crises that we see all around us. So Beneath the Surface is the show. KPFK is the station. You don't get anything like this anywhere else. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. This is better than a graduate degree education at just about any university in the world. I shouldn't say that because they're brilliant people who get graduate degrees around the world. But only they really match up in terms of the depth of understanding. That's only in a few departments that aren't polluted by, you know, reactionary money these days. So 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Call and I'm gonna just say, show.
Yeah, please do. Call in at 818-985-5735. Let's get some big contributions or whatever you can afford. Let's keep this radio station on the air, and let's keep me doing this until I'm too senile to continue. But I want to thank Alan, too, because, you know, for a long time he was my producer, and he's still a sort of, let's call it, informal producer, and he's helped an awful lot. And what Alan brought to the show was a little bit of comedy, and even we did some, you know, great sports show. But whatever it is, you know, we take it very seriously. This is not just something I'm doing as a day job. Take it seriously. Do a lot of preparation. And try to bring you the most information I can in a way that you can understand it, because I, you know, firmly believe that we can't be effective participants in our society unless we're armed with information. And not like, you know, now there's lots of places to get information, but there's not that many places to get the kind of analysis, I don't want to say fact-checking, but let's say scrupulously brought information that I try to bring each week. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, please call in and support this radio station. Let's try to make it better, and let's try to keep it on the air for the next millennium. That's a long time in the future. But Alan, let's hear from you.
Oh, well, just, I hope people right now just pick up the phone and call 818-985-5735. They can go to kpfk.org, make a donation, maybe, you know, make a note that it's for Beneath the Surface with Susie Weisman. I have learned so much from this show. I mean, I can't believe the wealth of insight and knowledge and historical background and just everything that makes that provides a strong foundation for intellectual understanding of the present I have received from Beneath the Surface. And getting to work with Susie on the show has been an incredible privilege for me. And again, I really do think for me working on it and for you, the listeners, getting to hear it, this is as good information as you can get to understand the world we live in any university graduate course anywhere in the world. The series of shows, I mean, who other than Mike Davis is the great author about the history, the real history, with understanding of Southern California. And where did Mike Davis's interviews appear in the media in Southern California? They were on Beneath the Surface with Susie Weisman more than any other show. That's just one example. In theater after theater after theater, as it were, around the world and in the country, the union movement, the political struggle, maybe in the Middle East or South Asia or East Asia or Russia or Western Europe, South America, incredible, incredible insight on this show, all of it placed inside the framework of the history that we're all living in this globalized world. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Call now. Please, please, please support Beneath the Surface.
Thank you so much, Alan Minsky, and I'm Susie Weisman. Remember, support the station and call in your pledge, 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Sebastian Budgen. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer, director Melissa Figueroa, and with editing and engineering help from Juliana Gota and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Weisman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Weisman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and please 818-985-5735 to pledge your support and keep this program and this radio station on the air. Stay tuned. I'm Susie Weisman.
Hi, I'm Marcy Winograd, co-producer of Code Pink Radio, Mondays, 4 p.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. I also report from Santa Barbara for KPFK's Rebel Alliance News. I've had a relationship with KPFK for decades. I can remember my mother frantically calling me up at 2 a.m. in the morning wanting to know what I was doing. I was still at KPFK editing a piece, a documentary on the coup in Chile, when thousands of people were rounded up in the stadium during a very ugly chapter in history funded by the CIA. We are lucky, we are fortunate to have KPFK in Los Angeles, and I hope that you also appreciate what KPFK has to offer, basically the truth that you don't hear on corporate media. So please do support KPFK. Give us a call, make a pledge, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or donate online at kpfk.org. Thanks so much for your support.
I was turning the radio dial in the car, trying to find something other than the and I just stumbled across KPFK, and I was just all of a sudden, I said, I had gotten off the nearest telephone booth. I called my wife and said, you have got to turn on 90.7 FM. I will talk to you when I get home. This is incredible. What I noticed was different, by the way, was that people were being interviewed at length. And when they were talking about the purpose for the station, the reason for being was to promote understanding among peoples of all races.
My name is Haile Garima, and you're listening to KPFK Pacifica Radio.